This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 319 for the week of September 7th, 2020. I am Fire Sweat David T. Cole, and I'm here with Lost Connection Sarah D. Bunting.
I don't get it.
Authorized Canada Arm Repair Technician Tara Ariano.
Sorry, you gotta wait for the parts to come from Winnipeg.
And Lonely Space Debris Ingu Kang.
I'm hurtling through space.
Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Grape. Joining us this week for the very first time from The Hollywood Reporter, it is TV critic Ingu Kang. Hello, Ingu.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Yay!
Oh my God.
We're thrilled to have you. We are going to get to our lead topic in just a moment, but first we have to make a correction. We were corrected by many people on Twitter from our last new non-clip episode featuring Brandon. We talked about Ruthless Realtor, the wonderful Lifetime movie. And he mentioned in his touting of Cyberbully, which was in fact an ABC Family movie, he said, you can't die from a Tylenol OD. You can die from a Tylenol OD. Please do not use Tylenol only as directed. It can kill you if you don't. I think he was misremembering that the way that the movie presented it is that the character cannot even get the lid off of the bottle. They don't even show her taking it. Like, they rush into the bathroom and she's like, I can't get it off. It's not funny, but it's funny.
I mean, if you can get water poisoning, you know, what hope is there for anything else on earth?
Honestly. But we're not here to talk about Cyberbully today, alas. We are here to talk about the new Netflix drama Away. The premise, briefly. Hilary Swank plays Emma Green. By the way, this is just a sidebar, one of the classic non-threatening lady names of fiction, right up there with Katie, Allie, Sophie, Molly, Emily. Anyway, she's the commander on the first mission to Mars. Her husband, Matt, who's played by Josh Charles, also went through astronaut training, but he was ruled ineligible for health reasons, and you better believe those come up again. When an emergency arises and is quickly contained on the trip from Earth to the lunar base that the Mars shuttle is launching from, two members of the international crew complain about how Emma handled it. They try to get her removed from her post, while a crisis back home makes Emma herself question whether she should resign her command and return to her family. But in the end, all kinds of history are made as the mission proceeds as planned. All 10 episodes dropped last Friday. Possibly we may talk about stuff from all over the season, so, you know, consider this your general spoiler warning, but we will take our Dave Chen note. We can quickly go around the horn and each answer, is this a good show that our listeners should watch? Ingu, what do you think?
Oh.
Thank you. We will get into it in more detail. I agree. Sarah?
Yeah, no.
Dave?
Yeah, I was trying to think of some Capcom thing, but yeah, Netflix, we have a problem.
Very good. Sarah.
no go flight.
We will give you a chance to explain your no in much more detail, of course. But so in case people don't want to be spoiled, that was our ruling. Okay, so Ingu, in your review at THR, which we will link to in the show notes, you write that Away, quote, seems to be aimed at masochists or sadists who want to see a woman accomplish the impossible, but also never not feel guilty about sometimes being away from her family. That was my read, too. My tweet while we were watching was that the alt log line could be, can women really have it all on Mars? So talk more about that and why this is a failing of the show.
I feel like I owe you guys an apology because I pushed for us to discuss this for honestly selfish reasons, because I knew I had to review this and I was like, well, that's a 2-for-1.
Totally.
Sure.
And then I felt so bad because the show kept going on and it never got really any better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole premise of the show I found really off-putting. I made some joke in my review about how it should be called Rocket Mom, because it's literally about like this woman who wants to go to space, but also she really wants to be a mom. And also this whole show takes place in some like weird future, like near future, where where an international space crew is going to Mars, which humankind has never done before. But also at the same time, she's like constantly able to text and email and get on the phone with her family. Not like through NASA, even though her husband works at NASA. Like she can just email her family directly. And so she's constantly helicopter parenting her teenage daughter. She's like, oh my God, you got a C on a test? That's not good, young lady. Like, you have to get, I'm going to like talk to your teacher and I'm going to get you a do-over test because you had some very bad things happen to you. And this is not who you are. This is like supreme white privilege, right? Like, you have to go into, you get to go into space and also you get to like, at the same time, like, rag on, like, your poor public school teacher to give, like, an underperforming student a makeup exam. Like,
uh-oh, we discovered a space Karen.
Yeah, I agree. Sarah, you also had an alternate title for this that we retweeted last night from our official Twitter feed. Go ahead.
Well, I tweeted that it's not going to work in a, you know, audio format, but the International Space Station is abbreviated ISS. So I was like, it's this ISS us. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, here's the thing, like you almost don't notice, or I didn't for a little while, how not good it is because the performances are good. Like these are all professionals. And at least in the first episode, there is enough processy stuff to keep me interested. But I am really not here for like super, super, super duper remote learning parenting show. Yeah. Like I'm also in the middle of this book called Dragonfly, which is about various, you know, breakdowns, both political and technological, on Mir in the late 90s by Brian Burrow. It's a very good, well-written book. And it, like, there is enough of that stuff, like that kind of story in the first couple of episodes that I was like, okay, like maybe it'll turn it around and stop being quite so much about like Lexi acting out because she has one parent in space and another parent who's receiving greetings like congrats on the erection from his friends at physical rehab. So, but it never turned it around, and it just mm-hmm. needed to be more about actual like the Martian day-to-day existence in space and way fewer flashbacks to how Rom feels like he killed his brother somehow because mm-hmm. they didn't quarantine properly. Like, I'm not sure I get it. Oh, wait, I do. Also boring.
The crazy thing is that, like, the mom is constantly worried about basically, like, the teen acting out. But, like, in, like, her really big act of acting out, her, like, mode of rebellion is going to church. Like, that's literally something that we see on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he's with a bad boy who takes her to math.
Yeah, I mean, my joke title alternate was also Gray's Astronomy, but I feel like that's so unfair because I feel like the Shonda Rhimes version of the show would have had bonkers elements. It wouldn't be so, like, stately. Like, anytime there's a possibility, full disclosure, we only watched the first three episodes, but anytime there was a possibility for something interesting or, like, scandalous to happen, it just defaults to, like, nice people being nice or competent or good. Like, you know, when there's the issue with this panels, and then Emma has to trust the Russian guy, Popov, to, like, grab her hand. It's like, I was like, oh, shit, this is where he's going to let her go and, like, take over the mission because he didn't trust her. And then he doesn't. It's like, oh, okay, like, that would have been interesting. I mean, it would have been ridiculous, but at least I would have been interested to see where it goes from there. Whereas it's just like every story seems to be about, like, Emma's such a great mom and a great leader, which is like, that's great for her team. Why am I watching this? You know, like, what is the show? What is this show? you know?
Well, and I understand that you can't fire someone in space, except what happens if you have to fire someone in space? Like, we all saw The Abyss. Mm-hmm. Like, it's bad when that happens. Let's explore that. I think Hilary Swank can handle it acting wise, but this is just sort of like, whatever home or like family drama in space, like Passola. Like, I got to like, oh, by the way, Merry Christmas. And I was like, you know what? And a Happy New Year to me. I'm not watching this shit anymore.
Yeah, like, it just feels very old-fashioned in a way. Like, this seems like there's a lot of shows where it's like, this would have been a great show that would have been unmissable 15 years ago, but now it's like, this is a C-minus and nobody has time for this. You know what I mean? Like, that was my feeling about it, basically.
Yeah.
And speaking of creative talent, since I mentioned Shonda Rhimes, like, what happened to Jason Kadams? I know he did not create this show. He's just an executive producer, but he did Friday Night Lights, but it feels like in the past few years, basically since Parenthood, I mean, I know people like The Path, I never watched it, but since Parenthood, he made About a Boy, the TV, like the sitcom, Pure Genius, which I think lasted 5 episodes, Rise, which we talked about, which was not good, Almost Family, which lasted 2 episodes and was super offensive. It really seems like he has lost the thread. Is it just me? Or like, should we have an intervention with this man? Ingu.
Yeah, this has like sort of like this is usiness like all written all over it. It's about like a bunch of like well-meaning, sad people who give each other a bunch of speeches. And I think you're supposed to take away from it some sort of like uplift. But also that's not entertaining.
Yeah.
Like, I would much rather go to Lexi's stupid midnight mass than if I wanted to like feel good about things. Like, it's 2020. I'm not here to feel good about things.
Yeah, to that point, I also wonder, like, if the glut of space shows, I mean, glut is maybe not fair. There's been like 3 in the past 5 years, but that's still a lot. I mean, 4, I guess, if you count Space Force, but I wonder how many of these started out being about like something else sciency, and then someone was like, well, we can't sell these. The only kind of science show anyone wants to watch has to be about space. Like, I just thought about like the number of stories that we saw where it was like, well, you know, showrunners that were interviewed, you know, a few months ago were saying, I tried to do a story about like the Innocence Project and then no one bought it. So I just had to do another regular lawyer show or whatever. Where if this started out its life as something where it's like, well, we wanted to do a show about, you know, a climate scientist, and then it had to be this instead. Like, I just wonder, shouldn't there be more shows about, like, dealing with real issues? Like, I feel like there's a moment in the pilot even where one of the reporters at the press conference asks, like, why should we, as a planet, be spending money on this when there are, you know, there are issues on that could help people directly now. And it's sort of hand waved away where it's like, well, this is just a pittance like of, you know, what we spend on the military. And isn't it great that this is an international project? And it's like, okay, I guess like this is what people say about the Olympics too. And that's also kind of not great. I don't know.
Well, and I don't like in the US, like a lot of the space program is the military,
right?
Like, I don't know. It would have been pretty ballsy to have Emma be like, you know what? You're right. Which she basically does in the press conference. And then it's like credits.
Right.
Like an 11-minute show about how the space program really needs to not while there's rampant food insecurity. But
right.
I guess that's not a thing that Apple TV can market. So.
Right.
I did like one element of the show. I think that like, at least initially, there's a storyline about sort of like the burden of representation and like sort of having like being rendered essentially from a human into a symbol. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese character, the Chinese astronaut played by Vivian Wu, I thought like that actually was detailed pretty nicely because she has been designated to be the first person to land on Mars. Like, she's going to be like the Neil Armstrong of Mars. Mm-hmm. And because this is already designated to be sort of her responsibility, and you can sort of like imagine all of these stupid like Twitter viral threads about like how, why it's amazing that like an Asian woman is like the first person to land on Mars, blah, blah, blah. I think they did a lot of like really interesting stuff with that and sort of like the pressure that she's under, especially the pressure to be heterosexual, which she's not really.
Yeah.
I thought like this would, we sort of discussed already that there are these constant flashbacks to their Earth lives. And I thought the only one that actually worked and had any sort of emotional resonance whatsoever was the one where basically she has a sort of like furtive relationship with another woman at Mission Control. Mm-hmm. I don't think that, like, don't shit where you eat. But also, it was a very touching, like, quasi-romance. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, like, in a year with, oh my God, I am totally blanking right now. The half of it. I think when the half of it came out, it sort of just like reminded me how so few of these stories there are about like Asian lesbians. Mm-hmm. And I really like that it sort of like went there. I think it's sort of foreshadowed in the pilot. And as soon as they foreshadowed it, I was like, oh, that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. But then the way they played it out was actually quite beautiful and like very wistful and sad. And the show has these like really like broadcasty, like the most obvious musical cues that you can possibly think of. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this episode used both Rocket Man by Elton John and also Debussy's Clair de Lune. And they both somehow actually worked. And I was shocked because it was this one episode, the only good episode of like the entire like 10 episode season that was actually done well and made me feel human emotions.
Mm-hmm. Well, we saw that one, so it seems like we don't have to watch any other.
You do not.
Yeah.
The Marge Simpson groan is the perfect response to the show.
It's time to go around the dial. First stop, Tara.
Yes, The Boys are back in town on Amazon. We talked about The Boys last season when season one premiered. If you do not recall, this is based on a comic book. It's a satire, sort of an action comedy series about a world where superheroes are real and a corporation named Vought sort of owns them and licenses them out to cities, basically, to do kind of extra police work.
It's superheroes meet Blackwater.
Yes. And toward the end of the first season, they basically struck a deal with the military to do that, you know, in on a grander scale, basically by giving Compound V, which is the substance that gives people superpowers, to terrorists to like manufacture attacks so that the superheroes could come in and solve them. And it was all like, you know, a false flag thing to advance their own interests, blah, blah, blah. So for season two, which just dropped, the first three episodes, so there will be eight, the same as season one, but they're not all dropping at once. I assume due to pandemic, Amazon is doling them out more slowly, but there's also an after show now with Aisha Tyler, so this might have been the strategy all along. Who can know? I will try not to be too spoilery past the first three episodes, which have already dropped. We pick up pretty much where we left off. The Chase Crawford Aquamanish character is in Ohio, drinking, feeling sorry for himself. Starlight, who is sort of one of our POV characters in season one, played by Aaron Moriarty, is a double agent. Huey, played by Sarah's best friend, Dennis Quaid's son, Jack, is, and the rest of the boys are fugitives. Both Butcher, Carl Urban, and Homelander, Anthony Starr, found Butcher's wife and the son that she's been raising, who is the product of Homelander's raping her several years earlier in some kind of crazy Truman Show neighborhood that Vought built. And Huey really loves Billy Joel, even more so in season two than he does in season one, I would say. We actually get whole sections of Billy Joel videos in season two, which we didn't before. Anyway, I thought season one was pretty crazy with the violence. Season two really goes places with it that impressed and astonished me. And that is coming from someone who spent several minutes this Sunday ranking all of the Jean-Claude Van Damme movies that I've seen and added a bunch more to my various streaming platform playlists. So someone is like just in the middle of a conversation when their head explodes spontaneously. And that happens in the first episode. So I don't want to ruin the climax of the third episode, but I will say, if you have a character in the show like this whose deal is that he controls the creatures of the ocean, this is what you do with him, what they do. I was really excited for, I couldn't remember that it happened in the first three episodes. Yeah. So I was like, Dave was watching these. I was like reading a book and like half paying attention. And I paid attention to this to see what his reaction was. And it was very good.
Yeah. So the scene is,
spoilers ahoy.
It's a chase scene basically. And they're trying to cut off the boys on a boat. Racing towards the shore. So the deep takes control of a blue whale or sperm whale or something like that.
And
sort of basically just tries to beach it in front of the storm drain entrance. And the guys, they just go through that fucking whale. but what they managed to do, though, is like in the moment, it's bonkers. But also it makes like somehow they made the deep like even more pathetic in season two than he was in season one. Like it was the whole pack, the whole package of that scene was quite something. How much they stuck in.
If you have an actor who is as good at being pretty and dumb as Chase Crawford is, you put him in a storyline about getting drafted into the Church of the Collective, which is not Scientology,
not
but
at all.
Certainly has Scientological elements, it seems. I don't know why Fresca is the official drink of this church, but I don't like it personally as a Fresca drinker. Also, now Americans know what Fresca cans look like in Canada because it's not the same as in America.
Yeah, you would think if Fresca was such a key piece of the prop puzzle that they would have brought a few cans with them.
Yeah, or send a PA to Buffalo. It's not far or expensive. Anyway. So replacing two members of the Seven also means auditioning regional soups with an eye to diversity in the corporate sense, which means like sort of like in less thoughtfully than what Ingu was describing with regard to Wang Lu. It's, you know, completely for optics and not really for any meaning. It seems like Homelander gets a lot to say about this, but then suddenly and with no discussion, Stormfront is joining the team and she's played by Aya Cash. It's a very big deal that there are three women in the Seven for the first time ever. And they have a whole catchphrase, girls get it done, and they're all disgusted by it, but they have to keep saying it because they're told to. And so without spoiling where her character's storyline is going, everything about the way they handle this is completely brilliant. Aya Cash is great from You're the Worst. She really goes for it in the role. I really wish the whole season had dropped so I could feel better about saying more about it. I'll just say you should watch it. I am not a superhero guy. This has been established, but it's so much smarter and sharper than it needs to be. And I would say it makes a good kind of like gonzo action comedy counterpart to Watchmen. They have, you know, similar themes, but very different approaches. And if you need to come down from Watchmen with something that has that's also smart, but has a little more levity, The Boys season two, it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Three more like mini plugs before I get to my plugs. Borgen, which we've talked about before, the Danish political drama new on Netflix for the first time.
Oh, really? Oh, yes. That's a must see. That's really good.
It's very good. Yeah. Joe Pera Talks With You, which we've also talked about. Formerly was only available in Adult Swim. It's just been added to HBO Max. And AP Bio season three. God, it was so funny. They had to stop their season two episodes short, but they really go some places in season three.
Well, this is their transition from network to Peacock, so they get a little more freedom to not only just for language, but just do some kind of thing.
They do some really weird things. Yeah. The last episode is because she is from Toledo, where the show is set. It's called Katie Holmes Day. It has very 30 Rock Leap Day vibes in terms of like this whole holiday that has all this kind of lore that's like Katie Holmes. I can't describe it. It's super dumb.
Yeah.
AP Bio season three, it's really, really good. For my actual plugs, I reviewed The Boys at Primetimer. We'll link that in the show notes. And I'm back at Mel for the first time in like 2 years. talking about my beloved Holy Moly and why it is so good, and all the shows that are trying to be Holy Moly never can because they do not have Joe Tessitore and Rob Riggle, the secret sauce of Holy Moly. And we'll link that in the show notes as well. Holy Moly season finale this week. I'm heartbroken.
Sorry.
Thank you, Dave.
Ingu, your turn. What do you have?
I have seen approximately 700 seasons of 90 Day Fiancé in the last year. And so I'm going to talk about it because it is probably my favorite show to talk about. And it is such delicious, delicious, sad, sad trash that I feel like I've probably like written in my head like 10 different think pieces about like why the show is, if not quite important, like the show of now. And yeah, anyway, you're going to hear about 90 Day Fiancé, which is a reality show on TLC. I'm not usually a reality or TLC person, which is why my own like obsession with 90 Day Fiancé has like really bewildered me. 90 Day Fiancé is not about like two random people who are basically like chosen to either get married in 90 days or not. It's actually named after a specific type of visa where a foreigner to the U.S. has 90 days to basically come to this country, and then they have that period of time to decide whether they're going to get married or not. And so essentially the OG version of this show, there's like 50 spinoffs at this point, and the show has existed for like literally 7 years. It's truly insane. Basically, you follow these two people who are engaged to be married, one American and one non-American. And the non-American has basically left their entire lives. They usually come to some podunk town. Their idea of like what America is supposed to be is completely wrong. And then, of course, because it's a reality show, they get completely bombarded with all sorts of stupid questions about like, oh, are you here for the right reasons? Do you want to get married because you really love this person or not? And usually, I think what's really truly amazing about the show is that I've seen a lot of criticism, valid criticism, about how the show stokes immigration fears, about how it sort of casts suspicion on the non-American and like their values and whether they're sort of like using America, quote unquote, in order to get a leg up in their life. But for me, the way that I inevitably see every relationship is that the Americans are just absolute losers. And so their only dating advantage is essentially to be someone who can offer citizenship. Like, that's like the depth of like American that we are talking about. Like, some of them do not have jobs. Some of them do not have their own place to live. Truly, their only advantage is that they can give some like poor, desperate soul the promise of a green card. As I said, this show is so amazingly sad at times, but also like doesn't ever really let you acknowledge that. However, there is like one spinoff version of 90 Day Fiancé that I love more than any other kind, which is called The Other Way, where it's usually a delusional American, oftentimes someone who has never left the country before, that they're going to marry someone that they met online and essentially go to that country and go live there, even though they have no idea what it's like to operate in a foreign country. Mm-hmm. And just like the depths of delusion that these people have is, this is a public service. Like, I don't know how else to express this. And yeah, I'm really glad that like I am married, and so I do not have to be subject to the kind of romantic desperation that drives these people, because truly, they're about for the grace of God go I probably.
Love it.
Questions?
No, this, I've watched a couple of seasons of the show. I can't remember why I fell away from it. I think it might have been when
just
we
the one that you watched. You're Married at First Sight, right?
I'm Married at First Sight. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a Love After Lockup guy. So we're really running the entire gauntlet of shitty sociological depth plumbing.
Yeah. I've heard about the other way, though, and that one intrigues me because I can definitely see the appeal of like an ignorant American in a foreign country, like just having no idea how to conduct themselves.
I mean, I don't, but like I've left the country before.
Mm-hmm.
And just I feel like there's also a lot of like toilet horror, which is one of those things where I completely relate to the Americans, but mm-hmm. also I would never in a million years let a camera crew follow me so that it could be broadcast on national TV with like boing boing sounds.
All right, I'm intrigued. you've convinced me to check it out.
Oh God.
All right. So we will link to your Twitter and to where people can find your writing. We already mentioned that you reviewed Away, so we will link that in our show notes as well so that people can find more of your work.
Can I actually put in a light, one tiny, tiny ray of positivity into this podcast?
Please do.
There's a Starz drama called P-Valley,
yes.
which I actually think is an amazingly legit, like, amazing drama. Have you guys talked about this on the show already?
Yeah, I talked about it probably a month ago, around the time that it premiered.
Okay. But the show is so astounding. It's so beautifully acted. It's so wonderfully written. It says so many things about America, just as hard-hitting as 90 Day Fiancé. And I will just echo you guys and really recommending the show because there's truly, it's one of those shows where you have to be grateful to peak TV because I don't know how else it could exist.
Yep.
But I'm really glad that it does.
100% agree.
Sarah D. Bunting.
It's been a really spacey week for me.
I was shocked to see this next to your name in our doc, by the way.
Yeah, it didn't seem right to me either, frankly. Explain yourself.
That's the one I'm taking, is one for all mankind. This is not, you guys talked about it months ago.
Yeah, we watched it.
I think when it, okay. It's the, you know, alternate history. What if the Soviets got to the moon first? I saw it mentioned in a Ringer piece that was like, here are things that you need to do with your space show. We'll link to this in the show notes. But the piece, first of all, posited that Away was pretty good, which don't agree. Mm-hmm. And also that like the one of the reasons it's good is that it spends so much time in mission control, which definitely don't agree. It doesn't spend enough time in mission control. But it pointed out that for all mankind, you spend a lot of time with the people on the ground. For All Mankind is not great, but I've watched a couple episodes and I think I'm going to keep going with it despite some, like, you know, he's cheating on me, like drama and parallel sort of double talk that I feel like Mad Men already did and way better. And, Joel Kinnaman, mm-hmm. I mean, that need I say more? I know I needn't say more to
I'm
Dave.
Asleep.
Except I do because Dave is asleep. he is so boring. It's really a pity because he is perfect for this kind of like Captain America looking role,
yeah.
But he's just like kind of a flat line on screen, but there is enough processy stuff and enough interesting sort of posers, I guess, about what would have been different if that one thing had changed. And you know, I don't know, like I'm sort of tuning out and like working on something else or watching the US Open on mute during some of the scenes. But then when they come back in and are sort of like doing a weird screensaver voiceover with Ted Kennedy deciding to cut short his trip to Chappaquiddick, it's like, okay, that's interesting. I mean, I think it's interesting. And since I'm also in the middle of this, you know, space book and just reviewed The Right Stuff on my Dennis Quaid podcast. It's just really spacey up in my life. But, For All Mankind is like, I understand why you would be surprised that I would watch it, but I'm, you know, already grading on a curve with it. Anyway, I'm going to keep going with it. I, like I said, did watch The Right Stuff with my co-host, Jeb Lund, for Quaid in Full. You can follow that on Twitter at Quaid in Full Pod. The Right Stuff is still a very good movie, and you're really in like peak Quaid, finally. In the 20th episode,
we get a
really
so
Quaid-y one. but I will also say to any assigning editors out there that I am prepared right now to do a ranked list of everyone who has played Deke Slayton in film and television. AMA, I work cheap.
You know there's a new series coming on Disney Plus next month, right?
I do.
Peace.
Next on Extra Extra Hot Great, our bonus show for our Patreon supporters. Very timely for Ingu's Around the Dial topic. It's 90 Day TV Fiancé.
No accidents.
Nope. In which our listener Jeff Spencer is having us pair up an American TV character and a foreign character from a different TV show and explaining how that goes for their marriage. Do they stay together, etc.? You can support us and hear about that if you go to our Patreon and support us, patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Any level of support gets you that bonus episode plus every bonus episode that came before. Boy, to the tune of that'll be episode 80. So that's quite quite a backlog now. If you were on the fence about when to get on board with Patreon, after the first of the month is always a good time. When they start charging cards, people inevitably fall away. So this is a wonderful time for you to help us by supporting us on Patreon. We thank all of our supporters and all of you who listen. Thank you so much. We love you. And on the next Extra Hot Great Prime, we're going to be doing a home shot reality show roundup with Andy Dehnart from Reality Blurred. In the spirit of our Quibi episode, it's going to be a general discussion, and then we're each going to talk specifically about one show that we watched. Am I going to be talking about the Dr. Pimple Popper and My Feet Are Killing Me home shot shows? Yes.
Only
so no one else has
Wait,
to watch
hang
them.
On. So it's people that have problems and they're just sending like phone videos to the doctor?
They're going to be showing their gross feet in lipomas on Zoom.
Portrait mode of a boobo.
So it's going to be all that with poor lighting and
yuck. No one else has to do it. This is I'm taking this on for science.
Science and TV is weird.
Yes. So that's on next week's Extra Hot Great. Plus other episodes of shows that are less disgusting. So
well, look forward to that. It is time for the canon this week. Our listener Catherine submits. Take it away, Catherine.
Hi, Extra Hot Great team. Catherine here. I grew up as a semi-regular viewer of The X-Files in the 90s, and a few years ago, I rewatched all 200-plus episodes of the original 9 seasons. Most of The X-Files episodes that I would nominate for the canon are already in it, but there are 2 more that I believe are canon-worthy, and I'm going to pitch one of them now, namely Season 2, Episode 20, titled Humbug. Humbug is the work of Darren Morgan, the series' most inventive writer. He wrote only a handful of episodes, but every single one is memorably clever and funny. Among them are canon inductees Jose Chung's From Outer Space and Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. Morgan often sought to subvert audience expectations and indeed the very formula of The X-Files itself. And that's exactly what Humbug does, right from its cold open. On a moonlit night in Gibsonton, Florida, we see 2 little boys playing in a swimming pool. Then we see the watchful eye and scaly skin of a figure sneaking up on them. The boys scream and splash as the creature grabs them, but it turns out it's just their goofy dad, a sideshow performer with some sort of dermatological condition, who has just come home from touring with a traveling show. Already, the episode has challenged our skin-deep snap judgments and begun to blur the lines between monstrosity and normalcy. But wait, there's another monster lurking. As the dad sends the kids into the house, we just barely glimpse a slimy, shadowy presence that jumps into the pool and lunges for him. Gerald Glazebrook, the alligator man, as his touring van reveals his stage name to be, meets a bloody end. At FBI headquarters, Mulder explains to Scully that 48 bizarre attacks like this one have happened all across the country over the past 28 years. But in examining the crime scene photos, Scully is more troubled by the alligator man's skin condition than by his evisceration. "Imagine going through your whole life looking like this," she says. Mulder and Scully head to the funeral, where they, and we, catch on that the victim was part of a whole community of freaks in Gibsonton. The clergyman has no arms and turns the pages of the Bible with his feet. The alligator man's widow is a bearded lady. Among the mourners, we get our first look at Lanny, played by the late great character actor Vincent Schiavelli. In real life, Schiavelli had a genetic condition called Marfan syndrome, which contributed to his distinctive appearance. But the character, Lanny, has two other things going on. One, a raging booze habit, and two, an underdeveloped conjoined twin protruding from his abdomen. The eulogy is interrupted when a man digs his way up from the ground under the casket and hammers a metal spike into his own chest. This show-off, we later learn, is Dr. Blockhead, played by Jim Rose, the frontman of a real traveling circus that was popular in the 90s. In the next scene, Sheriff James Hamilton tells Mulder and Scully about the history of Gibsonton, which, Wikipedia will confirm, is a real Florida town that actually served as a home base for circus performers. The sheriff and Scully have an exchange that continues to turn our ideas of normalcy inside out.
You know, this town's history might help explain our case's history. A sideshow performer would have toured much of the country over the years, and their isolation from everyday society caused by their physical deformities could have built up pathological resentment so intense that murder might...
No, hold on a second. Around here, we refer to them as very special people. Now, some of them may be different on the outside, but it's what's inside that counts, and on the inside, they're as normal as anybody.
Until their arrest, many serial killers are considered by their friends and family to be quite normal. If you truly regard these people as normal, then you must also consider the possibility that they are capable of committing these crimes.
The sheriff then takes the agents to meet Hepcat Helm, the proprietor of a funhouse. Sorry, a tabernacle of terror. Hepcat tells them about an infamous P.T. Barnum hoax called the Fiji Mermaid, which was actually a mummified monkey sewn onto the tail of a fish. This kind of fakery is called humbug, hence the episode's title. But Mulder, true to form, wants to believe that a real Fiji mermonkey might have killed the alligator man. Mulder and Scully check into a trailer court run by a guy named Mr. Nutt. The actor who plays him, Michael J. Anderson, is perhaps best known as the man from another place on Twin Peaks. Mr. Nutt lectures Mulder for the insulting assumption that he, as a little person, must be affiliated with, or, in his words, enslaved by, a sideshow. But his own stereotypical assumption that Mulder, with his dour demeanor and unimaginative necktie design, must be an FBI agent, is, of course, dead on. Lanny carries the agent's bags for them, because he works for Mr. Nutt now, but he tells them about his past on the sideshow circuit with his conjoined brother, Leonard. Lanny is endearingly polite, but he staggers off, sipping from his flask. Later that night, the small pink monster, of whom we once again catch only a glimpse, climbs through a window and kills Hepcat Helm. The next morning, we meet the final key figure in this mystery, the Conundrum, whose name is hilarious if you know that he's played by a real-life circus performer known as the Enigma. Mulder's first look at the Conundrum, covered in a loincloth and blue puzzle piece tattoos and hobbling up out of a stream to gnaw on a freshly caught salmon, remains an iconic X-Files image. Dr. Blockhead later explains that the Conundrum is a geek. That means he'll eat anything, including, quote, live animals, dead animals, rocks, light bulbs, corkscrews, battery cables, and cranberries, unquote. While Mulder gets some blood evidence analyzed, Scully visits a museum of oddities, where a half-normal-looking, half-odd-looking man tells her about the deaths of Chang and Ang Bunker, the original so-called Siamese twins.
On a cold January eve in 1874, Ang awoke to find his brother had passed away during the course of the night. A few hours later, Ang himself departed from this world. Now, these facts themselves may be less than fascinating, but imagine being Ang and lying there, knowing that essentially half your body was now dead, that the rest must inevitably follow, and being able to do about it absolutely nothing. At the autopsy, it was officially concluded that Chang died of a cerebral hemorrhage.
What was the official cause of Aang's death?
Fright.
This is the episode's most chilling scene, and a foreshadowing of events to come. But it ends on an amusing note, when Scully's usual skepticism fails her, and the man swindles her out of $5. The investigation continues, with Mulder growing suspicious of all these weirdos, including Dr. Blockhead and Mr. Nut. Then Scully reveals that even Sheriff James Hamilton had a freakish past, as a hair-covered, feral child put on display as Jim Jim, the dog-faced boy. The agents see the sheriff burying something in his yard by moonlight and sneak in to dig it up, leading to what is perhaps the episode's funniest run of dialogue.
May I ask what you're doing?
We're exhuming your potato.
May I ask why?
Sheriff, it's been documented that many serial killers possess a fascination with police work. Some of them even holding positions on their local force. So surveillance of investigation team members is often utilized as a precaution.
We found out you used to be a dog-faced boy.
As Mulder and Scully get caught up in their own prejudices, Mr. Nut gets caught and killed by the monster. Lanny becomes wildly upset when he learns that the killer squeezed in through the doggy door, and the sheriff hauls him off to the drunk tank. The agents try to arrest Dr. Blockhead, but he's an escape artist, so he escapes, only to have the sheriff catch him by the fish hooks he's embedded in his own chest. Lanny's wailing summons everyone to the drunk tank, where the identity of the monster finally becomes clear. It's Leonard, who has been unconjoining himself from Lanny's abdomen, sneaking out and trying to reconjoin with other people, killing them in the process. Vincent Schiavelli's delivery of what turns out to be Lanny's dying lines is heartbreaking.
How could I turn him in without turning myself in?
Lanny, why does he attack other people?
I don't think he knows he's harming anyone. He's merely seeking another brother. It hurts. It hurts not to be wanted. I don't know why he hates me so. I've taken care of him for all of our lives. Maybe that is the reason why.
How long can he survive outside of your body?
Long enough to understand that you cannot change the way you were born. Don't worry. He'll come back. He always does. I'm still his only brother.
Mulder and Scully pursue Leonard and wind up, of course, chasing him through Hepcat's Tabernacle of Terror, while they navigate its dark passageways, trapdoors, and Hall of Mirrors, Leonard returns to the trailer park and attacks the conundrum. By the time the agents catch up, Leonard seems to have vanished. There is only the tattooed geek lying on the ground, rubbing his distended and gurgling belly. The episode concludes the next day with Dr. Blockhead lamenting to Scully that 21st century technology will soon eradicate all physiological anomalies, and all human beings will look like Mulder, who's right there posing in his extremely 90s suit and tie and trench coat, like some douchebag catalog model. Imagine going through your whole life looking like that, Dr. Blockhead says, echoing Scully's line about the alligator man. This was early enough in the run of the X-Files that they were still dressing Scully frumpily and treating Mulder as the good-looking one, as if Gillian Anderson wasn't even more gorgeous. Anyway, the episode's killer punchline is also the only line delivered by the conundrum, who looks ill as Dr. Blockhead drives off with him, but grins as he says it's, quote, probably something I ate. Thanks for your patience with all of this plot summarizing. It's necessary to convey how deftly the episode swings between horror and humor, and how cleverly the various elements of the mystery twist and tie together by the end. But what I find even more impressive than the plot is the episode's paradox-filled exploration of the concepts of normalcy and deviance. Let's not forget that the whole premise of The X-Files is that Mulder and Scully are armed agents of the U.S. government, whose job it is to investigate and rectify situations that are suspiciously weird. This episode places them in a community in which just about everybody else's paying job is, or once was, to be ostentatiously weird. In this setting, deviation from the norm is the norm. One character's freakishness poses a deadly threat, but another character's freakishness ultimately neutralizes that threat by literally feeding off of it. I'm a wheelchair user, and as a viewer who has lived my entire life with a disability, I find this theme especially resonant. It is, in my experience and those of many other disabled and otherwise marginalized people, endlessly tricky to negotiate a relationship to normalcy when one has a body and/or a mind that can never quite be normal. I appreciate how Darren Morgan introduces us to characters who demonstrate a variety of approaches. We can be like Mr. Nutt, refusing to put our differences on display, and instead striving for respectable success by the standards of society at large. Like Dr. Blockhead, we can loudly resist societal norms and cultivate our freakish traits and abilities with disdain for everyone else's boring sameness. Or we can build a multifaceted life that has room for our freakishness and our normalcy. Like Gerald Glazebrook, who is both an alligator man and a family man. If this deep existential stuff doesn't convince you to vote humbug into the canon, remember that there's also a joke about Scully's boobs, a joke about Mulder's balls, and a joke for which young Gillian Anderson actually put at least one live cricket in her mouth. You can see behind-the-scenes footage of this on YouTube. You might dock the episode some points for the performative speechifying of some characters, or for the cheap hokiness of some visual effects, particularly the puppet or whatever it is of Leonard, the detached twin crawling around. But I would argue that these bits of obvious artifice are fitting for the carnival sideshow theme. After all, as Hepcat Helm teaches us about the Fiji Mermaid, sometimes being fully aware that an attraction is humbug makes audiences enjoy it even more. I hope all of this, plus the authenticity of the casting, helps humbug make the cut for the canon. Even if it doesn't, I have another X-Files episode to pitch to you later. Thanks.
Thank you, Catherine. Ingu, you picked this from our list of submissions. Why don't you respond first? What did you think of this, of the episode and of this argument?
I love this episode. I had not watched this episode in probably something like 10 years. But, you know, I put it on. It's on Hulu. Within like a couple of minutes, I was like, obviously this is going in. I really appreciated Catherine's summary of sort of like the, I think one of the really great things about the Darren Morgan episodes is the outside view that he brings to Mulder and Scully. So often the X-Files episodes are seen from their point of view. Mm-hmm. And I really love that one of the things that he does really well in this episode and also Jose Chung is that he's able to see what the outsiders and the lonely people, like apparently lonelier than Mulder, would make of Mulder and Scully coming into their town. Darren Morgan is sort of like the X-Files patron saint of egos and sadness. And this is a really prime example of that. But I do want to take a bit of an issue with Catherine's analysis about sort of, I think that The X-Files is definitely about how America is so much weirder than we think it is. It sort of is this like perfect show for the 90s where we thought we were living at the end of history and everything was so boring and everything was so white and everything was so suburban. But one thing that really ended up rankling me like in a tiny but lingering way about this episode is that all of the quote unquote freaks are white guys. And but that I found actually really disappointing, if they had sort of made a point about how white men are allowed to be more deviant and it's sort of allowed to be more outlandish or performative or showboaty about their own deviance from the norm. I think that would have made the episode a little bit stronger. And I think that, you know, Mulder and Scully are going into this all-white town. And essentially, they're sort of being told, like, everything is going to look like you guys now, sort of like the white bread version of America, and all of this freakishness is going to disappear. I think it was something that we... I think that that was, like, a very, like, 90s fear. I feel like Gattaca is, like, another really good example of this fear that, like, greater scientific advancement is going to smooth away at, like, the edges of society. But there's sort of, like, no acknowledgement of, like, the vast medical inequality in America. And also, there's this thing called racial diversity, and there's sort of, like, no acknowledgement that, like, there's not other different kinds of diversity. And so I know that, like, that's not, like, sort of, like, the core point of the show, but it is a conspicuousness that I found really notable. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, it did. Sarah?
I probably hadn't seen this in 10 or 12 years either. We're exhuming your potato is history's greatest acting robots, greatest line delivery. run that program all day. I found there to be this rue to this episode, which I think is what everyone has been talking about vis-a-vis, like, the sort of anxiety that America is just going to be this crustless white bread center and, like, we're losing all the weirdness to it. As a native New Jerseyan, this is like a sort of, this is like a state anxiety that it's like, you know, keep it weird. But, like, New Jersey is weird in some really shitty ways as well. Like, there's a lot of abandoned mental hospitals. There's a lot of racism. So I think that this is the sort of more nostalgic, sunshiny view of keeping a place or your idea of a place or a time weird, so to say. But for that, but it also works really well. And I think that this is sort of a hallmark of the episodes that Catherine was talking about in her analysis too, that these particular episodes tend to have this, heavy heartedness to them, even though they're quite witty. At the same time, I would also like to note that, come my funeral, hopefully many years from now, please someone burst out from underneath it and do a magic trick. I just think that would be pretty fun. Like, let's lighten the mood. This episode, there are certain episodes that, you know, we revisit for the canon of the X-Files that you're sort of like, if you haven't seen it in a while, sometimes they can really come at you in a different way. And sometimes that's really good for the episode's chances. And sometimes it's really not because it hasn't aged well. But this was like the overarching thing for me was this sense of sadness to this episode. And also to watching it a little bit, like, you know, that Schiavelli is no longer with us and that I thought his performance was really lovely, and you could kind of probably do a whole prequel series about him. And also, I am sort of minorly obsessed with Tara Tomas, so that's my issue, and I will speak to a therapist about it now that August is over. I'm not sure how I'm going to vote, but I enjoyed revisiting this episode and sort of, you know, thinking about America's relationship with circuses and sideshows and how, like, America's relationship with everything, it's pretty fucked up.
Just to add to one thing that Sarah said, I think this particular combination of wit and like deep melancholy is something that seems so pervasive on TV now. There's just like this like entire genre now of sort of like sad comedies. And I thought this was a really great progenitor of that mode that we
really
see all the
point.
Time now, but was much more of like a, what's the word? Was much a bigger piece of narrative progress in 1995 or whenever this was.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I'll go next. I think you make a great point about racial diversity, especially since they were filming in Vancouver, so you can't really say.
Not that this matters, but I was curious, so I looked up the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow performers, and at the time there was one woman who was in it. I don't know if she was the bearded lady in it. She said that she played herself. So, and that's she was married to Jim Rose. Beyond that, this all men, except for later on the lineup way past this, there was one more woman. And it seems like a lot of them come from the WWE after they retire, which is weird. But okay. But so there's that info for you. Jake the Snake Roberts was a member of the Jim Rose.
Okay, doing like strongman stuff.
Probably.
Anyway, to my what I was started to say was you can't say that they couldn't find, you know.
Oh, God, no.
Asian people in Vancouver. There's a huge Asian population there, of course. So, you know, just Canada can be white depending on where you go, but that is not the case in BC for sure.
I think Lucy Liu is in an episode in like the next season.
Oh, really? She's not Canadian. That's crazy. Oh, okay.
Terrible, terrible episode about Chinese ghosts and there's gambling involved.
Right.
Because there's always gambling involved.
Right. However, I will say that the minister who does not have arms and turns the pages of the Bible with his feet is played by Regina's own Alvin Law. He is from the town where I grew up. Aww. And he was like a known person. He actually ran for office when I was a kid. And the reason that he did not have arms is that when his mother was pregnant with him, she took thalidomide. So he is now like a motivational speaker, but he was a performer as well. And so, you know, while I take your point with regard to racial representation, that's completely valid. I also take Catherine's point that like, there's something to be said for having disabled people play disabled people, because I thought that with regard to Away, certainly that like it must be frustrating if you're a wheelchair using actor to see people who are not wheelchair users get those parts. I mean, certainly there are story reasons why, you know, if somebody has an accident or, you know, experiences something where then they start using a wheelchair for story reasons that's, you know. But then you have someone like, you know, Artie in Glee, like as soon as we meet him, he uses a wheelchair. So like, why would you not cast a wheelchair user from the start? Like, so there's, you know, there are certainly conversations to be had about this, but for this show to be casting disabled people this far back, like that was not usual, even in an episode like this, where like there are reasons for there to be like little person performers and so on. So, you know, let's grade them on a curve like it was the 90s. But like they, you know, Darren Morgan is like trying to make a point about like it, and has, as Catherine said, speechifying in dialogue with you know, Mulder and Scully asking like, are we profiling people? Which like, yes, they are.
Yeah.
So anyway, I appreciate that he's trying to have these arguments, and like some of them felt like they were ahead of their time and some of them felt like they were very of their time.
Yeah.
Like, I sort of want to add that like what I was trying to say about race, which I don't think I said it very well. It's not that my point is not that like among the people with disabilities, why aren't there also people of color? Like, I think that's a valid point, but that's not specifically the point I was trying to make. I think what I was trying to get at is that I feel like the X-Files as a whole, and this episode in particular, responds to this generalized fear about the coming homogenization of America, but the culture at large was ignoring all of the diversity that was like already within it.
Right.
And so in order to look for these differences, it's going into these tiny little corners, but ignoring like the sort of other diversities, like that's already in their face.
Okay.
Yeah. That was sort of like the point I was trying to get at in case there was any confusion.
Yes, I agree. To get back to this episode, it and speaking of it being of its time, wow, is there a more 90s icon than Jim Rose of the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow? As soon as he showed up, it was like, oh, take me back. Yeah. Take me back to the 90s.
Oh, no, the spin doctors are somewhere around here.
Yeah. put this in a rock block with the episode of The Simpsons where Homer is in the sideshow at Lollapalooza.
Right.
You know, like, this is very, very, yeah, very much of its era.
Tiny backpack.
Yeah. Tiny barrettes in your center parted hair. Mm. But also, like, there are a lot of, like, just small character touches that are, I thought, very sweet and revealed the thought that went into the story. The potato moment is great, but I also like when they show the sheriff the flyer from his Jim days, and he's like, "Oh, look how skinny I was."
I love that.
Or the double robe closing.
The double robe closing that Catherine mentions that she was in when she was wrapping up. It is true as she self-clocked that the Leonard puppet is very shitty looking, possibly intentionally, as you know, as a genuine fake. Maybe that's the point.
Yeah.
The funhouse climax, I thought, was legitimately felt scary and claustrophobic. I thought that was handled very well and was well directed.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a classic episode for a reason, and she took us through, and I thought explicated well why that is. So
yeah,
I thought it was a great, great presentation. Good job. Ingo, did you have one other thing to say before we vote?
Yes. I think I sort of almost inevitably thought a lot about American Horror Story's fourth season, which I think is it Sideshow or Freak Show?
Freak Show.
Yeah.
Freak Show. And sort of why that season was so terrible and what was sort of like quietly charming about this one. And I think something that I really ended up appreciating is that almost every time that they go speak to someone in the town, they are like really, they're like very protective of the community and the people inside it. And yet at the same time, they're constantly throwing aspersions against each other. And they're saying, oh, that type of like performer is stupid, or like this type of performer is the worst. And it just made so much sense to me that as a group of showbiz people, they all have like their own ideas about what constitutes good performance and what constitutes good deviance versus bad deviance. And they have this like whole like internal ranking system within their heads that they're always desperate to tell outsiders so that the outsiders looks at the deviance in their own through their own lens. And I thought that was like something that was like a really human touch. And even though Mulder and Scully are coming into this world as a sort of like us versus them binary, the people within the community already have these like very entrenched ideas that are really idiosyncratic about like how they view all of the different nuances in the town. I really love that detail, and it kept coming up, and it was something I hadn't really noticed about the episode and like the seven other times I'd seen it. And so I just wanted to shout that out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also kind of felt like an office scenario where everybody knows better than the boss right above them and always has the secret sauce if only somebody would listen. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But are also like taking advantage of this time to like having a captive audience to like, I'm going to tell you how shit is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So let's put this to the official vote. Ingu, what say you? Canon worthy or not?
Absolutely canon worthy.
And Sarah D. Bunting?
I forgot to say that for a second before I realized it was crickets. I thought Scully ate a bee, which was amazing.
So close.
Wonderful. That's a different episode where Mulder makes fun of her for going on some weird bee venom diet, which is very goopy of her.
Yeah, not in character. But yes, this is canon worthy. Yes for me.
Tara?
Me as well.
All right, I'm going to say yes. So that means it's 4-4-4. That means The X-Files Season 2, Episode 20, Humbug. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for our winner and loser of the week. Sarah has the winner.
I certainly do. It is Andre Dawson, whose life as a baseball Hall of Famer turned funeral home owner is being adapted as a TV series at CBS. I am going to reserve some judgment there because I think there are a lot of directions they could go with this that being CBS will be not bunt nip, but I'll try anything once.
Oh, but what's the baseball pun title for this show? Let's think that over as Tara gives us the loser of the week.
Oh, this is a heartbreaker. Loser of the week, The Venture Brothers, canceled at Adult Swim after 7 seasons in the traditional amount of time for 7 seasons, 17 years. This is a mystery. They were apparently in the middle of writing season 8 when they got the news and like have known for a while, and it just came out as we're recording this on Tuesday. They just announced it yesterday, and it's weird. It's been a weird week for TV news like this. The other is Mom is about to go back shooting, speaking of CBS, and then like sometime last week they were like, oh, by the way, Anna Faris isn't coming back. Bye. And they're like, wait, what? Like, she's one of the two leads of that show. Which is very strange. And they were like, yeah, we've known for a few months. No further questions. Like, okay.
Yeah, wow. I'm like, interested to hear that.
Yeah.
The leaks that come out of that situation.
Yeah. So
So what I'm hearing is if we have any bad news to deliver, we should do so soon.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. The title of that show is called The Dugout.
Uh-huh. Oh, I get it. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's good. Very good.
God. Speaking of both bad answers to good questions, do you know what time it is? It is, in fact. I had 45 seconds to come up with that
title. Yeah, no, that's very good.
I thought that was all right. All right, guys, this is the fifth game time of the season. Our scores are Tara 2, Sarah 1, Value Guests with 1. Today we are playing Like TV But Silent and Boring, the novelization game time. Once again, for those keeping track at home, Like TV But Silent and Boring, the novelization game time. It comes from our good friend David Ellis Dickerson, who earns himself an extra credit topic. Many TV shows throughout the decades have produced spin-off books, usually in a series. This game time will feature information about a novel based on a TV show. You have to guess what show it's from. That's all there is to it.
Okay.
Except we have multiple levels of hints here.
Okay.
I am going to give you the title and the year of the novelization. Most of them are impossible to guess from that. A few, I think you have a chance. So you get a free crack at the show after I give you that information.
Okay.
You get it at that point, I'm going to give you a treasure of 3 points.
Wow.
We are against the clock, so we're going to skip Equalizer.
We're going to, yes. After that, there are 2 clues.
Okay.
Usually summaries or opinions taken from Amazon reviews, sometimes information from the book covers.
Okay.
Note that sometimes these novels were published well after the show has ended. So take that in consideration when you hear the year.
Okay.
No stealing today. No equalizer zones. We're going to rush right through it. So let's get it to Pinky to see who will be going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. We're going Tara, Ingu, Sarah. Are we ready to play Like TV, But Silent and Boring, the novelization game time?
Yes, sir.
Tara. Bad Bargain 2018. Free guess at the show right away.
Price is Right.
First hint. It's time to raise money for the band the year before the band candy incident.
Buffy.
Buffy is
the Vampire Slayer.
Correct. 1 point.
Okay.
All right, Ingu, here is your first question. The title of the novelization is Goblins, and it is from 2008. Any idea what that might be?
Supernatural.
Supernatural. Incorrect. Here is your first clue.
That's what I'd guessed.
Me too.
Goblins is the monster of the week variety of episode and does nothing to further the redacted mythos.
X-Files.
Hey, how about that?
Hey.
Oh.
2 points. Sarah D. Bunting.
Wait, 2 points? So was my last one worth 2 points?
Yeah, shouldn't Tara have gotten 2?
Yes. 3, 2, 1.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. Sarah. Alexis Returns, 1984.
Dynasty.
That's worth three.
Nice.
Back to Tara.
Yep.
Extracurricular Activities, 1977.
Welcome back, Cotter.
That's a great guess.
Okay.
That is
from
really
the
good.
Front cover. Redacted tests her dynamic powers against the worst that man and nature has to offer! Exclamation point.
The Bionic Woman.
The Bionic Woman is correct. 2 points. Okay. Back to Ingu. A Little Yuletide Murder, 1998.
Murder, She Wrote.
Is, in fact,
nice.
Right.
What?
Nice guess.
Very nicely done.
This is a heartwarming Christmas tale set in Cabot Cove, Maine, was the first clue.
See?
Sarah Day Bunting, Heatwave 2009.
Beverly Hills 90210.
I loved Redacted from the very first episode, but never expected to have the chance to read a book written by the character, although he is an author in the show.
What? The Flash. I don't know.
Incorrect. Last clue. The next three novels in the series are Naked Heat, Heat Rises, and Frozen Heat.
What?
Yeah.
Heat Rises and Frozen Heat?
Yeah. Naked Heat, Heat Rises, and Frozen Heat. Written by the character who's an author of the show. Gonna need an answer.
Castle.
Ah, that was my guess.
Wow.
Nicely done. Tara.
Yep.
The Icy Touch, 2013.
Is it the Icy Touch of Frozen Heat? The Icy Touch. Batman.
I realize Blank was a fusion of cop procedural and monster movie from The Get, but this one goes too far into the realm of the latter to have made a viable episode.
The Punisher.
Unfortunately, Sean Renard is often referred to incorrectly as Hexenbeast rather than Zauberbeast. Moreau drives a VW bug, not a van. The plural of Blutblad is Blutbladen, and Nick cannot tell what Vessen they are if they are not Vogue. If you are, I don't know what any of these words mean. If you are a fan, be prepared for these and many other inconsistencies. Wow, I should have read that in the comic book guy voice. Unfortunately,
I thought I had it, but then I remembered that
Hexen Beast.
Yeah.
Zauber Beast.
Right.
Blutbad. Blutbaden.
All of my guesses were actual books, so I'm just going to say True Blood, but I know that's wrong.
We're looking for Grimm.
Grimm.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, that sentence just kept on going, too. I thought it ended, and then it kept on going. I was looking for the period, and then, like, more crazy words came up. Ingu, Loch Ness, Leap, 1997.
Oh, boy. Next clue, please.
Okay. Your next clue is, I thought you were about to give the answer when you said, oh, boy. That's a free clue for you at this stage.
Wait, what was the hint?
My non-hint hint for you is when you said, oh, boy, I thought you were actually being clever and was going to give me the answer of the TV show right after that.
No, I'm terrible at trivia.
Okay, that's fine. Here is your first real clip. I was always disappointed that the TV show was not able to do more with his daughter, Sammy Jo, and was very glad that this book stepped up to the task. The book also does a terrific job tying in what was going on at The Project.
Oh, boy. Highlander, I don't know.
Okay, another thing that doesn't add up for me is how, despite her off-the-charts IQ, she could not connect the Dr. Beckett she works for with her grandmother's walk-in named Sam.
I know it's not Beckett, but I'm just going to say Beckett so I can get this over with.
The answer was Quantum Leap, and at the end of every episode of Quantum Leap where he jumps into another person, he says the words, oh boy, which is why I thought you were being clever when you said that and you were about to give me the answer in a blaze of glory. So I apologize for setting you up for that one. Sarah D. Bunting, Little Green Men 2002.
X-Files.
Good guess. We already had the X-Files. So.
Oh, I didn't realize you couldn't repeat them. All right. Well,
there we go. You want another guess since I didn't give you that information? Have at it.
No. Okay. Continue.
Set in early March, about a month after the episode in which the teens dealt with the alien crystals in the cave, it seems the alien organisms have spread into part of the city water supply.
Roswell?
You are correct. 2 points. Tutara.
Yep.
Mind-altering murderer. 2011.
Mind-altering or mind?
Mind-altering murderer.
Psych. What?
Oh my god, nice.
Why did you guess psych on that?
Because he's like a fake psychic.
Oh, okay.
And he solves crime.
What you're saying is my delivery helped you answer that.
No, once I clarified it was mind and not mine. It wasn't about that disaster from Wales from the Crown.
The Abber or whatever.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, Ingu, we have Mr. Redacted and the Two Assistants, 2007. So Mr. Title Character and the Two Assistants, 2007.
Mr. Doctor Who.
Mrs. Doctor Who the Monarch. While Blank is at the hospital with his assistant, whose teenage daughter has broken her wrist, he is startled to see his former assistant working there as a nurse and not in New Jersey like he thought. Conflict ensues when it's clear she wants her old job back.
What year is this?
2007.
Honestly, this sounds like a Sopranos episode to me.
Sopranos, incorrect. One more clue for you. This novel, like all the novels in the series, was written by series creator Lee Goldberg and is narrated in the voice of Blank's assistant, Natalie.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Wait, does someone else know the answer?
Yeah, Sarah knows. Sarah knows because she watched this show.
Yeah. Because the town in New Jersey she's supposed to be in is my hometown.
Oh, really?
Yes.
All right. Any idea, Ingu, what that is?
Mr. Grey's Anatomy.
Sarah?
It is Monk. If you never watched the show, you would never get it based on the hints.
Yeah, it is.
If you did, Monk. You were foaming at the mouth just now.
Okay, wait. How is Mr. Monk, like, any more sensical than Mr. Doctor?
It's the way they named all the episodes.
Well, I mean, is Doctor Who's last name Doctor? I mean, that's the question.
Mr. Monk and the Thing.
Yeah. I would love to believe that Doctor Who's real name is
Mr. Doctor Who.
Mr. Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Yep. It might be.
It is now.
Sarah. Blank. That's Blank, title of the show. The Final Dossier. 2017.
Alias.
The novel fills in details of the 25 years between the second and third season and expands on some of the mysteries raised in the new episodes.
Twin Peaks?
Correct. 2 points. Back to Tara.
Luis. Yes.
Power Play. 1987. The decade of power plays.
L.A. Law.
Okay. Unique for this book is a little bit of explanation about how the various Blank family members see and treat the South Fork servants.
Dallas.
2 points. Back to Ingu. No Secrets, 1992.
LA Law.
All right. You need to know, this is from a reviewer in the UK. Of course, we know well that in the States, they speak the same language as us, and the five-figure zip code is actually their postcode. But there is a sharp division in the U.S. between those which might accept a British postcode as an equivalent and those who simply cannot accept it for an order of goods.
Next hint, please.
Amazon description now coming at you. Minnesota natives Blank and Blank discover love and heartbreak at their new school in California. Oh, wait. Before you answer, I'll summarize the hints for you. We got some guy from the UK is going on and on about zip codes.
It's clearly 90210.
That's good for 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting. Redemption. Yes. From the year 2000. Redemption.
Redemption?
Redemption.
Redemption. Profit.
I'll take guess.
A wealthy actress, Whitley Tyler, requests the help of our heroes. She plays a vampire in a popular TV show, and a small number of viewers seem to believe she's actually a real vampire and have made attempts to kill her.
Oh. Buffy again? Oh, no, it can't be Buffy. Never mind. And have made attempts to kill her.
Yep.
I don't know what this could be. X-Files? I don't know. I need
to already answered. Doyle is pleased the case isn't relying on painful visions.
Oh, fuck.
And Cordelia is starstruck, but our hero is confused.
Angel.
He is confused because Whitney resembles someone he knew 2 centuries earlier, guys.
It's always the way.
One point. All right, this is question 16 for Tara.
Yes.
Revenge.
Okay.
2008.
Revenge.
I mean, I don't blame you for answering
that.
You know,
I had to do it.
She did a good job with her main plot of a ghost who's murdered and then comes back to reap revenge. I'm reading this from the review. I know that doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
On the person he thinks did it. This falls in line with the premise of the show that ghosts are often wrong or confused about situations or people that happened when they were alive.
The ghost whisperer?
The ghost whisperer.
Okay.
Oh, she did a good job with her main plot. Okay.
Ghosts are not the only people who are often confused. I'm
Ingu.
Very confused right now.
Red's Untold Tale 2018.
Red Shoe Diaries.
As a fan of blank, I've always been curious about Ruby/Red's childhood. This book gives you a glimpse into her growing up with her granny. The only complaint I had was that there was very little about her being the wolf.
Oh, what's that ABC show about the stupid fairy tale people?
I cannot confirm nor deny you're thinking about the absolute right show.
Guys, I feel like that's obviously the right answer, but you know what? If you want me to sabotage myself, I'll just say that 70s show.
That's incorrect.
I was thinking it.
I could give you the next clue, but you know what it is. You just don't know the title. So I'm going to give you one of the words in the title as your next clue.
And that's
time.
Once upon a time.
All right, we'll give you 1 point for once upon a time. Well done. Sarah D. Bunting, Sin City 2002.
CSI.
CSI, which one?
Original Flavor.
Correct, 3 points.
Nice, Sarah pulls into the lead.
All right, this is question 19. 19.
The Hardcastle.
Shadow of the Sphinx, 2003.
Oh my God. Shadow of the Sphinx. 0 hour.
0 hour. Incorrect.
Wow.
The next novel in the series is titled Something Wiccan This Way Comes.
Charmed.
That is correct. 2 points.
Okay.
Ingu, your last question. That was your last question, Dar.
Okay.
Ingu, your last question. Scotland the Brave, 1996.
Quantum Leap.
Oh boy. While there isn't a lot of swordplay, this was an interesting story of an immortal actor's quest for revenge against our hero. More flashbacks would have been nice, but it was still a good read.
I genuinely have no idea. Next hint, please.
This franchise has its highs and its lows. The original film, which was brilliant, the sequels, which were terrible, and then the television series, which started slow, but then became very good by the second season.
It's not Highlander, is it?
It is Highlander. And our last question of the game for Sarah D. Bunt.
Sarah, by the way, needs 1 point to tie, 2 points to win. 3 points to eviscerate me.
Okay.
Jeez.
Good luck.
From 1965
title is completely redacted because it's exactly the same as the TV show, 1965.
Ooh, shit. The Prisoner.
Good guess.
Front cover copy reads, the sexy, hexy new novel based on the season's number one TV show.
Hexy?
Sexy, hexy. That's hyphenated. Sexy, hexy.
Bewitched?
Bewitched is, in fact, the correct answer. So Sarah pulls ahead right at the very end. Quickly, let's use this tiebreaker for a future steel mill. First person to shout out the answer wins.
Okay.
Everybody is in on this. Wagon Train to the Stars, 2000. The captain has to lead a
Futurama.
The captain has to lead a colony ship with over 50,000 settlers on a course that takes him between two warring alien races and far from the Federation.
Star Trek.
Star Trek. Wagon Train to the Stars, the original concept for Star Trek. You're using it as a title.
Sarah.
Let's hear the final scores, please.
Oh, Lord.
Ingu finished with 8 points. I had 13. Sarah, our victor, with 14 points.
Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We tried to balance having a career and getting through away before going around the dial with stops at The Boys, 90 Day Fiancé, and For All Mankind. Catherine made the successful pitch for X-Files Humbug for the EHG canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from David. Next up, it's 90 Day TV Fiancé on Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it's an at-home reality roundup. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Look how skinny I was.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Big laughs, I tell you. Big laughs.
And Ingu Kang.
That's Mr. Dr. Kang to you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Good night. Sleep tight. Don't let the bed bugs bite. No, that's not what I meant. I didn't mean to imply we had bed bugs.